This is VOA News. I'm Jim Bertel. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo on Sunday staunchly defended the drone attack that killed top Iranian general Qasem Soleimani, but refused to publicly offer any evidence supporting the American claim that he posed an imminent threat to U.S. forces and officials in the Mideast. Appearing on ABC's This Week, Pompeo says the drone attack was a strong warning to the Iranian regime.
We've told the Iranian regime enough. You can't get away with using proxy forces and think your homeland will be safe and secure. We're going to respond against the actual decision makers, the people who are causing this threat from the Islamic Republic of Iran. We're going to take this seriously, and we're going to defend the American people at every turn.
Appearing on the same program, Senate Minority Leader Democrat Chuck Schumer says this is another example of an out-of-control president.
This president has made a mess of foreign policy. North Korea, they're much stronger than they were when he started. In Syria, he messed up. Every encounter he has with Putin, he loses. And so I am really worried, and that is why Congress must assert itself.
With Iran vowing revenge, VOA's national security correspondent Jeff Selden says his sources worry about a military attack.
So there's a lot of concern that U.S. forces could come under attack, but they also worry, intelligence officials long have worried, that Iran has a terror network at its disposal. It's been able to strike in places as far away as Buenos Aires, Argentina. In South America, it's been able to pull off plots in Bulgaria. So it has a long reach, and it can strike the U.S. in ways which are not necessarily easy to defend against.
That's VOA's national security correspondent, Jeff Selden. For more on this story or any of today's news, please go to voanews.com or use the VOA mobile app. From Washington, this is VOA News. Iraq's parliament has passed a resolution calling for foreign troops to leave the country. The resolution calls on the government to work to end the presence of any foreign troops on Iraqi soil and prohibit them from using its land, airspace, or water for any reason. Australia continues to battle wildfires that have scorched millions of hectares across three states. Cooler temperatures and lighter winds Sunday brought little relief from the fires that firefighters have battled for weeks. Reuters' Adam Reed has more.
Finally, some respite for residents in southern parts of Australia, as cooler temperatures and some much-needed rain mean an easing for now from the devastating bushfires that have raged throughout the region. Evacuations are continuing as thick smoke still hangs in the air. In the town of Eden in New South Wales, residents hung on to what belongings they could and waited for buses and boats to take them to safety. Similar scenes in other small towns across the state saw residents wait for news of what remains of their homes and businesses. Initial estimates put damaged or destroyed properties in the hundreds, but authorities said that the mass evacuations by residents of at-risk areas appear to have prevented major loss of life.
That is Reuters' Adam Reed reporting. Somali militant group Al-Shabaab says it attacked a military base used by U.S. and Kenyan military teams Sunday. The U.S. military's Africa Command says initial reports reflect damage to equipment and infrastructure, and the situation remains tense. In a statement, Al-Shabaab said it had taken control of part of the camp and it had inflicted casualties in the attack. Kenya Defense Forces also said in a statement they fought off the attackers and four militants were killed. At least 60 people have died and nearly 100,000 people are unable to return home days after devastating rains flooded the Indonesian capital of Jakarta. Some 11,000 health workers were deployed across the greater Jakarta area Sunday to spray chemicals and distribute medicine to prevent the spread of diseases. Tens of thousands of people remain in temporary shelters. The Golden Globes, the first big award show of the season and a test of likely Oscar contenders, will be given out Sunday night in Los Angeles. Here's AP's Julie Walker.
Not afraid of tough guys, are you?
Will The Irishman win Best Film Drama in a close race against Joker, Marriage Story, The Two Popes? There's also 1917 in that category. As for Best Film Comedy or Musical,
that's my stunt double, Cliff Booth.
Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is getting a lot of buzz. It's up against Dolomite Is My Name, Jojo Rabbit, Knives Out, and Rocket Man.
They pay to see Elton John.
The Globes are voted on by the Hollywood Foreign Press Association. I'm Julie Walker.
And from Washington, I'm Jim Bertel, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
They are aware that currently focus is on retaliatory attack as a result of what happened in Baghdad. So to them, this is an opportunity for them also to rebrand themselves internationally.
The Somali militant group Al-Shabaab claims responsibility for attacking a military base U.S. and Kenya military teams used Sunday.
Challenges are there, yes, but we are saying we are going to face them, and we hope and believe we shall transcend those challenges. So, nonetheless, we are on the move. So we keep moving, we keep engaging, we want to observe the law, and we keep saying we don't want any confrontation with the security personnel and all of that, but nonetheless, we are going to move with our engagement.
Bobi Wine, a popular Ugandan parliamentarian, plans to embark on consultations beginning Monday as he prepares to challenge President Yoweri Museveni in next year's presidential poll.
He uses the military to declare himself a winner. That's not a mark of a Democrat. So he's politicking because next year wants to be a bed of roses for him. He knows the challenge at hand, and therefore he's trying to keep relevant, despite the fact that openly opposition to his rule is increasing day by day.
And President Yoweri Museveni continues his six-day jungle walk to retrace the route his guerrilla forces used to seize power decades ago. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Somali militant group Al-Shabaab says it attacked a military base used by U.S. and Kenyan military teams Sunday. The station is situated in Lamu County along the Kenya-Somali border. For VOA, Mohammed Yusuf reports from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
A cloud of black smoke will be seen rising from a military base in the coastal town of Lamu. The base hosts Kenya and American forces. Somali Islamist group Al-Shabaab has claimed responsibility for the Sunday attack. In a statement, the U.S. military command in Africa, known as AFRICOM, confirmed some of the smoke could have originated from the destruction of equipment at the base. Lamu County Commissioner Irungu Masharia confirmed the attack and says the area is not yet secured.
Between 4 and 5, there was that attack at that military base. That airstrip, officers engaged in the intruders, and it has continued until around 6. But the situation has now calmed down, but the area is still not secure for us to go to that place. But life has returned to normal. Officers are on the ground.
In a statement, Al-Shabaab said it had taken control of part of the camp and it had inflicted casualties in the attack. Kenya Defense Forces also said in a statement they fought off the attackers and 4 militants were killed. One witness, who didn't want to be named for fear of reprisal, spoke to VOA about how he was woken up by explosions, followed by hours of gunfire sound. We had heavy explosions at around 4, he said. In the beginning, we thought these were the usual explosions we hear around the area. Then we saw a fire and thick black smoke. Then, for a while, it was quiet. At around 6, then we had gun attacks up to 8. It was at that time we saw a plane dropping something that looked like bombs. Witnesses told VOA there was still a heavy security presence in and around the area. Security officers could be seen asking some civilians to produce their identification documents. Richard Tuta, a security expert based in Nairobi, says Al-Shabaab are seeking recognition as U.S.-Iranian tension grows after the U.S. airstrike that killed the Iranian Quds Force commander, General Qasem Soleimani.
They are aware that currently focus is on retaliatory attack as a result of what happened in Baghdad. So to them, this is an opportunity for them also to rebrand themselves internationally. That's why, despite the fact that they knew very well that they were going to lose, but they had to do it in order to rebrand themselves international.
The attack comes days after Al-Shabaab fighters killed three people on a passenger bus in Lamu County. The area that borders Somalia has been the target of security operations for the last 5 years. Al-Shabaab has carried out wave of attacks against Kenyan security forces and civilians in the coast and northeastern region. Mohammed Yusuf for VA News, Nairobi.
Meanwhile, for the latest development, I reach Mwenda Mbijiwe, a Kenyan security analyst.
This is an area that is, you know, frequented by terrorists. Actually, the main reason that our Kenyan military in the past crossed the border to go and pursue Al-Shabaab in Somalia was because in this area, the terrorists had kidnapped a French on a tourist trip to Kenya and took them to Somalia. And so this is an area that has had terrorist activities for the longest. And so them coming to the base today, well, of course, it's surprising that they're there at a military base, furthermore, one that has American forces. But again, it's not quite a big surprise because we are used to Al-Shabaab operations in this part of our country. Suffice to say that it's not so far from the Somali border. So that's an area where Al-Shabaab basically has been. But interestingly, is that most of the fighters in the force in that area are not necessarily foreign fighters. They are Kenyan young men that have been recruited and trained into the Al-Shabaab terrorist group.
But Mwenda, some people are suggesting that with the latest development of the U.S. strike against the Iranian army commander, it is surprising that there wasn't any heightened alert at this base, particularly when people are aware that the army base is used by both Kenyan and U.S. military forces.
Sure. And since that attack, security has been beefed up around the city of Nairobi. Malls and places have increased security. I hear across the country, military bases and police bases have all been asked to be a little vigilant. However, I think the surprise came in the fact that there has not been a lot of allegiance by terrorist groups to Iran. As you know, Iran is Shiite Muslim faith. And so not many terrorist groups subscribe to Shiite faith, especially in Africa. Most terrorist groups in Africa are of the Sunni descent of the Islamic faith. And so I think that caught intelligence advisors by surprise. But again, that they attacked this morning, then it means one thing. For sure, the commander that was killed, like President Trump said, has had a lot of influence on terrorist activities around the world. And particularly, a U.S. official has said that commander that was killed had been funding and organizing terrorist attacks in Kenya. And this is a clear indication that that position is correct and that Al-Shabaab surely gets some form of support, whether financial or technical support from Iran. And that is a clear message today.
What has been the response of the Kenyan Defense Force so far? Because I understand that a nearby civilian airport has been opened for use following the repelling of the attack by the Kenyan forces.
Yes, earlier in the morning they had blocked the flights, but they have since reopened them. But the area of the base that was attacked is next to the bush, next to the forest, and that's where the American Special Forces are located. So they came right through the forest, over the fence, and hit the airstrip part of the U.S. Military that has U.S. military planes. So they burnt a couple of planes. I'm sure you've seen the photos making rounds in social media. But then there was no human casualties. There was speed in repelling them. And the Kenyan defense forces on their side of the base also took cover. And photos of course have been making rounds on social media of the soldiers taking on the defensive position. So there was no human life loss, but the equipment and a couple of military facilities were hurt. However, as it is, the military has since repelled them.
I understand that a few days ago there was another attack. Who was responsible for the attack and what has been the response of the government so far in reassuring the public following today's attack that they are safe?
Well, the attack, yes, indeed happened a couple of days ago. The terrorists, attacked a bus. A public bus, shot at it, but the driver managed to drive way off past the shooters until the wheels completely became flat and they couldn't move no more. But that's an area, as I said, of course, they killed two people in the bus, but others, were able to disembark and hide in the bushes until rescue came. So it's an area that is infested with terrorists, as I said, and unfortunately, most of them are local terrorists. They are they are sons of our country that have been radicalized and made violent extremists. So, yeah, indeed, it's an area that our terrorist activities move all the time.
Mwenda Mbijiwe is a Kenyan security analyst. He spoke with me from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. Robert Kyagulanyi, popularly known as Bobi Wine, is a Ugandan parliamentarian who plans to begin consultations with his supporters beginning Monday. Bobi Wine, the leader of the People Power Movement, has announced plans to challenge President Yoweri Museveni in the 2021 general election. To learn more about his consultation plans, I read Joel Senyonyi, spokesperson for the People Power Movement.
All right, so according to our laws, our Presidential Elections Act, Section 3 thereof, it provides that anybody who is desirous of becoming president of Uganda can write to the Electoral Commission notifying them about his or her intentions. And in the same vein, notify them about their desire to go around the country consulting with Ugandans about the same matter. And so, following the law, we wrote to the Electoral Commission to begin our countrywide consultations engaging Ugandans about this subject matter that we have somebody that is aspiring to become president. That's the Honorable Robert Kyagulanyi Ssentamu, also known as Bobi Wine. And so the Electoral Commission wrote back to us and told us, of course, to follow all the laws, notify the authorities, police, and so on. And we are doing all of that. We have done all of that, actually, notified police, notified the local authorities. And so we are hitting the ground running tomorrow, Monday, and we're going to begin in the constituency of Bobi Wine. He will pretty much be saying goodbye to the constituents since he's now going to vie for the presidency. And after that, we'll go across the country, the rest of the country, consulting with Ugandans about the same subject matter.
What feedback have you gotten so far in anticipation of the walk on Monday, particularly in terms of his decision to challenge and wrestle power legally from President Yoweri Museveni, who is also embarking on a six-day jungle walk?
Yeah, so because our regime is a dictatorial one, Mr. Museveni will want to go across the country, engage with Ugandans, interact with them, and yet he does not want anyone else to do that. And so, yes, we have had some challenges here and there. Some of the venues we had booked initially to use for our consultation, security folks went and intimidated them. So they withdrew consent, and yet we had even deposited monies and all these different things. So those are challenges that we are grappling with, given that we are operating in a dictatorial setting. But nonetheless, we keep moving. We are insistent on following and observing the law, but we'll keep moving and make sure that our work gets done of consulting Ugandans.
What does this work entail, if I may ask you?
Yeah, so majorly, it should go and interact with Ugandans. So we'll be at particular venues where many people will have come, and then we'll tell them about the intentions of Honorable Kyagulanyi, Bobi Wine, to run. And then we'll ask for feedback. You know, we'll have them ask questions, for example, telling us what their view is, what their thoughts are. We're going to interact with them. So they'll give us feedback. Feedback, ask questions, and all of that. That's the kind of setting it's going to be like.
People have expressed concern that Robert Kyagulanyi or Bobi Wine could be putting his life in danger by visibly trying to challenge President Museveni, looking at the fact that opposition protests have usually turned violent with clashes with the police. What steps are you going to take to ensure that tomorrow's walk does not turn violent?
Obviously, it's risky stuff when you decide that you're now going to go against a dictator like ours. Mr. Museveni has been in power for coming to 34 years now. He's pretty much in charge of the army. He even calls it his army, says the army is mine. The money is his, you know, and all of these different things. And as the world knows, Bobi Wine was brutalized to near death in Arua. And so it's risky. But then we want change. Our country is yearning for change. Every part of the country that we have gone to, Ugandans keep saying, we want change. And so we cannot back down and be fearful because of the challenges that come with all of this. The challenges are there, yes, but we are saying we are going to face them, and we hope and believe we shall transcend those challenges. So nonetheless, we are on the move. So we keep moving, we keep engaging, we want to observe the law, and we keep saying we don't want any confrontation with the security personnel and all of that. But nonetheless, we are going to move with our engagement.
Joel Senyonyi is the spokesperson for the Ugandan Opposition People Power Movement. He spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. Meanwhile, a Ugandan opposition parliamentarian says the six-day jungle walk President Yoweri Museveni is embarking on appears to be a public relations exercise. Matthias Mpuuga says it is unlikely Ugandans will learn anything new from the president who has ruled the East African country since 1986. His remarks come as the president began his walk through the jungle, aimed to retrace the route which enabled his guerrilla forces to overthrow General Okele Lutua's government. For reaction to the president's walk, irate opposition parliamentarian Matthias Mpuuga.
The walk is not just a comedy, but a walk of shame, because the first port through which Mr. Museveni walked is barely 20 kilometers from Kampala City, and it all smells poverty, deprivation. You can actually mirror the greed of this restarted 5-year-old regime when you walk with him through the trek. So he's actually on a walk of shame. Well, he went through that trek 35 years ago, he himself impoverished. He is now walking with his pot-bellied colleague to go and show off to the impoverished. They have they deprived of their wealth, their land. Actually, some of the people walking with him have grabbed land in those areas. So it's a walk of shame.
But let me ask you this. Some people are saying this is significant to enable the young ones to learn the history of the country, and that never again should we have a violent overthrow of a legitimately elected government, and that this is an actual history we should be learned, because a country that has not learned history is bound to repeat the mistakes made over the years. Your thoughts on that?
I'm afraid history is not just learned by walking. Bad history can only be learned again by good deeds. Mr. Museveni himself is occupying power illegally. He stole elections, been brutalizing Ugandans to sit in the state house. So there's no lesson we can learn from him out of that simple walk, because really, we all know his intention was to teach Ugandans history. He should have left power after his first two terms. He has changed the constitution twice. Age, then term limit. So what is there to learn from him? If it's about learning, then we are learning from a bad teacher. So there's nothing positive to learn from his actions right now. And therefore, I insist it's a walk of shame. As long as he remains in power and rigs the elections, brutalizes the opposition, somehow, somewhere, Ugandans have a constitutional mandate that the constitution allows, even including extra constitutional means. Because I don't know for how long the younger people are going to tolerate either any constitutional occupation of state house.
Some people are suggesting that this is a second walk that he is trying to bring attention to people after going for a walk to highlight the need to fight corruption, and that President Museveni is really showing true leadership, which should be emulated by all Ugandans. Your thoughts?
Certainly, I know Mr. Museveni cannot fight corruption. Be asking of him to cut off his hand, actually cutting off his head. He can't cut off his head. Corruption is an institution through which he thrives. He bribes, he is bribable, he is surrounded by the corrupt. The Inspector General of Government has stated before that actually when he chases the corrupt, they all run to state house. His ministers have checked records, he's not changed them. So I think he's just trying to dupe the country into believing that, the political challenges facing him into the country right now are forcing him into desperate actions. I am aware, for example, that the said walk of shame is some reaction towards the walk. I mean, the country visit consultations that are going to be undertaken by the young opposition leader, the Honorable Tshagulanyi, who is starting his activities tomorrow from the northwest of the country. So Mr. Museveni wants to be active too. So that Tshagulanyi does not grab the headlines alone. So he's trying to grab the headlines, but there's nothing actually practicable he's doing.
Some people are suggesting that this is a move to try to rally his supporters in anticipation of next year's general election. Do you side with that assessment? Some people are believing that President Museveni is going to win the election because of the fractured opposition. There's no agreement in unity to present a single candidate that could pose a possible challenge in the elections next year. Your thoughts?
I think we are talking about two issues. One, the fact that Mr. Museveni thinks he must win at all costs. Of course, that's why I'm saying that the said walk is an attempt to be politically relevant. But secondly, the fact that the opposition is fractured does not justify Mr. Museveni rigging and brutalizing of the opposition and denying them of their political space. So he's simply politicking, and winning for him does not mean getting a majority vote. It means
criminally brutalizing the others and denying them access to the population and making sure he uses the military to declare himself a winner, that's not a mark of a Democrat. So he's politicking because next year won't really be a bed of roses for him. He knows the challenge at hand, and therefore he's trying to keep relevant, despite the fact that openly opposition to his rule is increasing day by day.
Mathias Mpuuga is a Ugandan opposition parliamentarian. He spoke with me from Kampala. In other news around the world, the United Nations Children's Fund is appealing to the warring parties in Syria to protect hundreds of thousands of children at risk of death and displacement from the carnage in and around the northwest province of Idlib. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
New Year's Day is traditionally a day of hope, a day when people look forward to a brighter year ahead. On this New Year's Day, UNICEF reports five children aged between 6 and 13 were killed when their primary school in Idlib province was hit by rocket fire. UNICEF spokeswoman Marixi Mercado acknowledges Syria's warring parties are not likely to respond to her agency's appeal for the fighting to stop, but she says they should.
The children in Syria who have absolutely nothing to do with this conflict are bearing the brunt of this conflict. A whole generation of children have known nothing now but war. How can that be a good thing for anybody?
Some 3 million civilians who live in Idlib province have nowhere to go. They are trapped. All avenues of escape from the fighting are blocked. The United Nations reports more than 235,000 people have been displaced within the region. This since Syrian forces and their Russian allies launched a military offensive to retake Idlib from Al-Qaeda-affiliated jihadists and rebel allies in mid-December. Children account for more than half of those forced to flee their homes. Many have already been displaced multiple times. Children's lives have been disrupted in many other ways as well. Over the past year, UNICEF reports 145 schools in Syria have been attacked, depriving tens of thousands of children of an education. The UN has verified 82 attacks on hospitals and medical staff, depriving children and adults alike of essential health care. Mercado says more than 90% of these attacks were in the northwest, including in Idlib. She tells VOA, young people in Syria are being robbed of their childhood and their dreams.
Some of the testimony that I've heard from mothers is it really hits home when they talk about the change that they see in their children, the lack of hope that their children express, and even the anger at being forced to live through such conditions. These are no conditions for children.
Mercado says UNICEF is on the ground in Syria doing what it can to keep children alive amid the violence, chaos, and biting winter cold. She says UNICEF and partner agencies are providing winter clothes and blankets, clean drinking water, health care, education, and psychological support. While these actions are saving lives, she says they are not enough. Only an end to war and peace, she says, will bring children the safety and prospect of a hopeful future they need and deserve. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
I'm Heather Maxwell, ethnomusicologist and host of Music Time in Africa. This weekend, I have a cool collection of songs from across the continent.
Happy New Year, Winanda. The country got mad. Amazing young.
You'll hear some brand new tunes like Happy New Year by Amaze from Liberia and Anjagala by Maro. You You'll also groove to classics like Shaluza Max from South Africa and Cesaria Evora from Cape Verde. So whether you're a regular weekender with me or you've never laid ears on Music Time in Africa, tune in this weekend, Saturdays and Sundays at 15:05 and 20:05 Universal Time.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Mpuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. And it's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Let's begin in Ghana, where the Ghana Football Association, GFA, has removed all its national team coaches. The GFA confirmed the departure of Kwesi Appiah as Black Stars coach, although the federation said his contract had already come to an end. The GFA has been under new leadership since October, following a year under the control of a normalization committee. The Black Stars resumed their international schedule in March when they played 2022 World Cup qualifiers. The changes go far beyond the Black Stars. The GFA statement said the decision affects both male and female national teams, which includes the under-17, under-20, and under-23s. Meanwhile, in the 2019-2020 Toto CAF Confederation Cup, it was a good weekend for debutants Pyramids of Egypt and Paradou of Algeria. Pyramids defeated compatriots and hosts Al Masry to continue their 100% winning record in Group A. In Group D, Paradou beat Enyimba of Nigeria to go second. Morocco's Hassania draw with Cote d'Ivoire's San Pedro 1-1 in Abidjan. In Group B, Guinea's Haroya made it two victories in a row, defeating Mali's Joliba in Conakry to go top on 7 points. In Johannesburg, South Africa's Bidfest Wits failed to score for the third game running, settling for a goalless draw with Libyan visitors Al Nassr. Both sides remained winless with 2 points. In Group C, last season's losing finalists RS Berkane of Morocco moved a step closer to the quarterfinals with a 3-0 home win over DR Congo's DC Motema Pembe. Zambia's Zanko made it 3 draws in as many matches, holding Benin debutants SI to a goalless draw in Porto Novo. To the first point for the Beninese side this term. Return matches are next Sunday, January 12th. Now in athletics, defending champions Cosmos Lagat and Wokanesh Alemu will return to the Tata Mumbai Marathon on January 19th. Kenya's Lagat won 12 months ago in a decisive fashion when he broke away from the rest of the leading pack and was on his own over the final 13 kilometers. Almost a third of the race. Lagat will be aiming to become just the second man to win back-to-back Tata Mumbai Marathon titles in the race's 17-year history. He'll be following in the footsteps of fellow Kenyan John Kalai, who won in 2007 and 2008. Race organizers have signed up no less than 14 men who have run faster than the 2-hour 10-minute mark, making it the strongest marathon ever to be staged in India. Among women like Lagat, Ethiopia's Alemo won the 2019 Mumbai Marathon in a personal best of 2 hours, 25 minutes and 25 seconds, which was also the second fastest winning time in the race history. Alemo heads a very strong women's field that has 8 women who have run under 2 hours, 28 minutes. All the leading women will have as their target the course record of 2 hours, 24 minutes and 33 seconds set by Kenya's Valentine Kipketei in 2013. In addition to the marathon, which has a total prize fund of over $400,000, there is a half marathon, a 10-kilometer race, a dream run, a senior citizens race, and a champions with disabilities race. About 50,000 runners are expected to take part. Meanwhile, the Mumbai Marathon will be followed a week later by the Standard Chartered Dubai Marathon. This has also drawn a powerful field of elite athletes. Ethiopia's 2017 winner, Wokonesh Degefam, and Kabebde Alemu Megetu head up the women's elite field, while Solomon Dekisa and Seif Futura, also from Ethiopia, lead the men's entries. Meanwhile, Ethiopia's Lamecho Gima and the three medalists from the European Cross Country Championships head the men's field at the 63rd edition of the Campasio Cross Country in Italy on January 6th. Kenya's Margaret Chelimo Chipkemboi leads the field in the women's race. And that's about it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent. And you're hearing from Jay Martins featuring DJ Arafat with Touching Body. Miriam Ferrer's Follow next with Wahishini A. Mario with Manyaku follows, and then Manifest featuring Simi with Big Man. Mafi Kizolo ends it all with Love Potion.
Dance with my messy boo. He dey beat me like Senna for Panya. Me like how she play the best line. It makes me sing ooh la la la. The way she move, the way she dat. It makes me sing ooh la la la. Oh yeah. When mommy come back, she a drop. Daddy come to me a cross. And when they ask me, it was me. That's why me talk say I don't like this shirt. That's your body. Waka. But she no say my mama no like them. Waka. I don't want this shirt. That's your body. Waka. But she no say
sagodi ka umba kapatia hana dosanya na vutia sebule kwa chumba kajazia ladha asali na natia akitupia anapendeza kama mdo lipsika mpaka raha kama gacho na madika hajatembezwa palo igo kama kumbuka mpaka raha jichogoro kama sama kisa
I'm a correct guy, forgiveness, please reply, baby.
What do I look like? What do I look like? Oh, you said you was a good guy, but you never do right. You wanna play me for a fool? You really wanna play me for a fool? Tell me what you gonna do? What you gonna do?
You know, say you're my first love. Even though I told you about my ex-loves, no, it sounds like a contradiction. My mission is cuddle, kiss, and give best hugs. I know I didn't call. Is that against the law? Why are you so appalled? You run and you grunt, and your friends tell you bounce first. I could, now I can't. You find a vibe in my pants. At least I was being safe. Can I
I get another chance, even though what I said was a stupid thing to say. Tougher than nails, too many times you drill me. Besides, I don't have any sack chicks to thrill me. Pay you attention, invoice and bill me. I'll go be your cash cow, go ahead, milk me.
I know you won't think I'm dumb. You do me bad for too long. And this betrayal so strong, so strong. I think I'm for some. Just walk away. I tell you better walk away. You done threw my love away. I moved on, I'm all the way. Tell me, what do I look like? What do I look like? But you said you was a good guy. Why you never do right?
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Although it has been suggested that there should be a number of clarifications to help resolve certain issues in southern Sudan and in South Africa's relations with China, as well as the Francophone relations with France, there are certain overarching factors that need to be discussed now because they have an important bearing on what Africans should expect in this new year. The reference is to those groups and associations that African states belong to since they achieved their independence. In many instances, these groups have served them well. But today, these groups are not working properly in their favor. If one takes the United Nations, many African states have joined it for the protection of their sovereignty. Today, any African state that looks to the Security Council to protect their sovereignty will be almost folly, because that is not what the Council is about these days. Secondly, the Africans used to depend on their friends in Asia and Latin America in the non-aligned groups, and they were able to achieve great results within the United Nations and outside by membership in that group. Today, the non-aligned group is extremely weak and is not doing what it did, say, 2 decades ago. And then you take also the African Union, the successor to the Organization of African Unity. The OAU performed extremely well, particularly under the Secretary Generalship of Dr. Salim Salim. And when the OAU was transformed to the African Union, there were promises that wonders will be made. Sadly, the African Union is mere shadow of what the OAU has accomplished, and the weakness of the African Union has opened the way for bad actors outside of Africa to exploit that weakness and cause problems on the African continent. And the last, of course, is the League of Arab States, because there are a number of African states in North Africa who are members of the League of Africa States. Under the old regime in the Arab world, the League of Arab States was a staunch defender of Pan-Africanism. Nasser was a founder of the OAU. But today, there is a general belief that the League of Arab States is not as strong as it used to be. And as somebody who has dealt with the Middle East for now over 50 years, I would agree with those who say the weakness of the League of Arab States has resulted in outside bad actors meddling in the Middle East and using issues which were not hitherto known, division between Shia and Sunni, to make it so difficult to resolve the Middle East crisis. Now, all these factors could be seen right now in Libya. And it is very important that Africans should pay attention to what has happened in Libya. They should not allow the passage of time to dull their memory to what happened. In the so-called African Arab Spring, there was an attempt, and successful one, to change regime in Libya. It was achieved when Colonel Gaddafi was killed. We know what was the result. The Africans were the victims. First, those Africans who had gone to Libya to find work became the victim in Libya. Then the jihadists moved south and caused a lot of problems in the Sahel, and they're still doing that. But those who promoted regime change have gone back to the capitals. In fact, being cozy where they are, and Libya has been left in utter chaos. So this is the result of regime change in Libya. And now it seems the last chapter is being played out. You have a situation where General Haftar is pushing and pushing to oust the government recognized by the United Nations. You have other governments like Egypt and others trying to use the League of Arab States to bolster Haftar. Then you have Turkey just last Saturday or last Friday passing a resolution to intervene in Libya. At least they could say they have been invited by the government in Tripoli that is being recognized by the United Nations. And you have various European governments playing games there. This is the future the Africans should be aware of. We are no longer living in a rule-based international community. What is a factor is military and economic might. They are the decisive factor. And if Africans don't learn that this is the case, they are in for a bit of trouble during this new year. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs.
Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Saleh, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Nelson Lopez, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, ashes fly back into the face of him who throws them. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.